Nearly 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Ukrainian civilians face another harsh winter made worse by Russia's systemic destruction of the country's energy infrastructure. While Russian troops failed to take Kyiv and were forced out of central Ukraine early in the conflict, Russia now controls much of eastern and southern Ukraine, where populations are subjected to forced Russification. You're listening to the latest podcast from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP for short, here in Berlin. This is where we discuss what's on the minds of policymakers, or at the very least, what should be on their minds. In today's episode, we'll discuss what's happening in the Russian-occupied territories of Ukraine and how this second front serves as the Kremlin's most important propaganda project in the absence of military successes elsewhere. I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to address these issues, I'm joined down the line today by Nikolai Petrov, who is a visiting fellow at SWP's Eastern Europe and Eurasia Division. Nikolai's research focuses on Russian domestic politics and its impact on foreign policy. Nikolai, thank you for joining us today. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Nikolai, perhaps you could start by painting a picture of the current situation. How much of a grip does Russia have on southern and eastern Ukraine?
Well, I would say that at present time, Russia occupies four regions of Ukraine, two so-called People's Republics, Luhansk and Donetsk. And only one of these four regions is controlled by Russian troops entirely. It's Luhansk region. Other regions, including Zaporizhia and Kherson regions of Ukraine, are controlled partly, something like, say, 50 to 60%, including the fact that in both cases, in Zaporizhia and Kherson, Russia doesn't control regional centers of these proper regions. And it looks like now there are 3.5 million persons, some of inhabitants of these regions left for other parts of Ukraine which are not occupied by Russia, some left for Russia itself, but now it looks like only 3.5 million remained. And among these remaining inhabitants, majority is composed by pensioners, by persons who didn't have any real choice, any real opportunity to leave from their parental homes, which makes it from one side easier for Moscow to control these regions. From other side, financial burden is huge because Russia should pay all social benefits for those who are staying there. And the last and perhaps important part of the picture is that Russia is doing large-scale reconstruction works. The major reason is to demonstrate that under Russian rule, they can live better than they lived in Ukraine. But nevertheless, Russia did invest huge money into restoring certain elements of infrastructure, into restoring housing, especially in Mariupol, which was almost demolished.
And what is life like, and as far as you can tell us this, for Ukrainians living in these frontline territories? I understand it's notoriously difficult for international organizations and independent journalists to access them. What is life like for the Ukrainians living there?
Well, I would say that it's not that easy to describe these lives, speaking about all these occupied territories, and of course, the life closer to front line looks different and more risky than the life, well, in more deep regions. But I would say that the aim of Russian occupational authorities is to demonstrate that the life is improving and it's good. And partly, they did manage to achieve their goal, or at least we do have something like, say, 130,000 of those who left from regions before the occupation and lived in western parts of Ukraine, who did decide to return, to come back. And you can understand that at the beginning of the occupation, when it looked like it would be for short, it was easier to leave from your home and to stay for a while. But now when it appeared that the life is going on, and it's not that easy, not that comfortable to live far away from your parental home. And the idea is now widespread that in those parts of occupied regions where Russia did invest a lot into restoring what is called a normal life, it's possible to come back and to stay there. And we should have in mind the fact of nested identity. Ordinary persons do not think they live in a huge country. They are living in much smaller parts of the country, and this is habitual parts, a habitual region, vernacular region where they did live and their parents and ancestors did live for pretty long. So when choosing between living in sovereign, independent Ukraine, but far away from their homes, or coming back, not necessarily to enjoy better and comfortable life, but to be closer to tombs of their ancestors, many of them do choose the second option.
And how easy or difficult is it to leave these territories or even return to them?
In case of return, they should first come to Moscow. And it's not that easy. They are going through Istanbul or other cities where there is direct plane communication with Russia. And then they should pass through the procedure of checking. And out of 130, which reportedly came to Sheremetyevo, this is Moscow airport, 20,000 were not allowed to come to Russia and to their homes through Russia, but more than 100,000 were allowed to do this. So it's pretty long route to go from Western Ukraine to Poland, to fly to Turkey, from Turkey to Moscow, and from Moscow back home in Kherson, for example.
So it's not easy to return, and you've already explained why some displaced persons would want to return to these regions. But returning to what everyday life is like, what about the violation of human rights? What are you hearing about there? Such as the forced deportation of children. That's something we're hearing a lot about in the press.
First of all, of course, there are violations of human rights, numerous violations, and they are connected to the fact that the war is going on, and part of those occupied territories are controlled even not by civilian authorities appointed by occupational authorities, but by military. The problem is that, we do have a lot of anecdotal information about all these violations. Some of them are intentional, some of them are more connected with uncertainty and instability and many different risks which you are facing when staying near the front line. A lot of international organizations are gathering this information. There are numerous facts reported about children taken to Russia. But I should mention that this is not necessarily a kind of black and white picture, although any occupation is by itself violation of basic civic and human rights. But in case of children, for example, we are more focused on how many of them, and especially orphans, were taken to Russia, but there was flow back, and recently it was reported that something like, say, 1,500 children were returned to Ukraine. But you should understand that in many cases, they either used to be orphans and staying in special facilities for orphans, or they became orphans, so their parents cannot be found easily, and to take them to Russia was the single way to save them, to take them from the front line. I am not saying that Russification is not going on, but I would oppose the idea that there is special master plan according to which Ukrainian children should forget about their ancestors, about their culture, and should be transformed into Russian citizens. I don't think that Russian authorities are that much focused on this, although it doesn't mean that human rights are not violated.
Well, talking about Moscow's aims, I understand that Putin is pretty involved. Why is this? What are his aims?
In my view, there is misunderstanding of Moscow, Putin's aims, especially now when there are a lot of discussions about how it's possible to conclude any deal with regard to the war, how to get ceasefire and everything else. In general, Putin's aim is not to get any additional territories. Russia is the biggest country in the world by size of its territory. It's, of course, not to get additional population. It was going on and it could be done much more easy and effectively. Putin's aim is to demonstrate that Russia came back and it's in its right to be taken into account when it goes about those territories which, in Putin's view, are parts of Russia's zone of interest. And that's why Putin, when speaking about future probable deal to be concluded, is not that much interested in the border, is not that much interested in getting or keeping control over a certain part of Ukrainian territory. He's interested, first of all, to control entirely Ukraine in terms of its foreign policy and not to allow it to go to the West, to become part of NATO and so on. So if some politicians in the West think that it's possible to get the deal humiliating Ukraine and forcing it to forget for a while at least about these territories, it's a mistake. Putin wants to humiliate the West. And unfortunately, I would say that at this stage of the war, he is much closer to his aim than a while ago.
You mentioned some of the reconstruction that's going on in these territories. Perhaps you can shed some light on the kind of projects taking place in terms of infrastructure, business, and how they serve Russia's political and economic policy.
Well, the region itself looks more like a black box. It's not that easy to get any information except for certain anecdotal evidences or official reports coming from Russian authorities. What is understandable, Russia is trying to restore infrastructure, both transportation, because this is territory near the front line, and transportation infrastructure is needed from one side to provide for military transportation from other side. And this was one of important plans. It's needed for Moscow to keep land bridge to Crimea, especially at a time when the bridge across Kerch Strait is under attack from Ukrainian military forces. It's needed to provide for, well, at least a certain normal life, including water consumption, including all basic infrastructure, including housing, and it's going on as well. But one of the most important reasons is to demonstrate that the life is improving in a fast way. And that's why Russia did invest a lot into reconstruction of Mariupol. Not only housing is reconstructing there, but there are theaters appearing and some other things to make this territory attractive for Ukrainians who are either staying there or left and are planning to come back.
And tell me, what hope does Ukraine have of reclaiming these territories? You've talked about Putin's wish to humiliate Ukraine and the West. But what hope is there of Ukraine ever reclaiming these territories?
First of all, and this is very important, I should think about this horrible war, not only in terms of states and territories, but in terms of human beings. And as long as military actions are going on, Ukraine perhaps can protect certain part of its territory, but it's losing very essential part of its population. And this is damage which cannot be restored anytime in future. And we should understand this, that letting the war, letting military actions to continue with their present day intensity, we are closing a bright future for Ukraine, because if and when the war ends, and will end sooner or later, well, many Ukrainians which left from the country will not come back, not to speak about those who are killed, and this is perhaps the best part of Ukrainian nation. That's why I would say that, in my view, the war is much more about human beings, and we need to think in these terms than about territories which can be protected or can be returned in a while. From the part of Moscow, there is no that much interest of a concrete borderline. The interest is to keep certain control over Ukrainian mainland. And if to speak about how the deal could look now, I think it will be somewhere in between Minsk II treaty concluded in 2015 and Istanbul draft treaty, which was discussed by Russian and Ukrainian delegations in 2022.
Well, that's about all we have time for today. So I would like to thank our guest, Nikolai Petrov. You'll find links to his latest work in the podcast show notes. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also keep up to date with the latest analyses from SWP on X, formerly Twitter, and on LinkedIn. So until next time, it's goodbye from our guest.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And also from me, thank you for tuning in.